like 10 minutes and less than 10 slides. So less than a minute per slide. It was not we ourselves who were moved towards God, nor did we ascend to God, but it was He who came and descended to us. It was not we who sought, but we were the object of His seeking. It was He who came to the earth and retrieved His own image, and He came to the place where the sheep was straying and lifted it up and stopped it from straying. I mean, it's, I hate to say it, but it's all God. Our salvation is all God. You know? And I think sometimes if we think about people who try to accomplish great things,
get it.
He's saying that we don't accomplish it. We don't accomplish salvation. You know? And we hear this at the beginning of Lent every year. We hear this at the beginning of every Lent every year. That fasting is not going to save us. That the number of prostrations we do is not going to save us. That it's God who saves us. And I think that it's a nice reminder. And it's just very vibrant. I mean, we don't ascend to God. God has descended to us. All we have to do is submit to His gifts. He did not remove us from here, but He made us heavenly while yet remaining on earth. And imparted to us the heavenly life without leading us up to heaven, but by bending heaven to us and bringing it down. We can experience heaven here and now. And we experience heaven here and now by the grace of God, by the gift of God, by Christ bending it down. Okay, I have this. Through the sacred mysteries, as through windows, the Son of Righteousness enters the dark world. When the sunlight enters a house, the lamp no longer attracts the sight of the onlookers, but the brightness of the sunlight overcomes it and dims it. I just put a picture there because I got tired of all the words. But, I mean, I think we know that image. It's like a lot of times we turn a light on before the sun rises, and then later on in the day, we don't even notice that the light's still on because there's so much sunlight. And so it's through the mysteries that the Son of Righteousness enters the dark world. And when we have Christ come into our reality, his brightness is so much that it overshadows everything else. Similarly, when in this life the brightness of the life to come enters through the mysteries and dwells in our souls, it overcomes the life which is in the flesh and the beauty of this world and conceals their brightness. And so it's through the mysteries. It's through sacraments. It's through this connection with God that the brightness of the life to come enters us. So we have a foretaste of paradise. We have this anticipatory, it's like a foretaste. I mean, if we were to have a birthday cake, I know this happens. You've got a big, beautiful birthday cake. At some point, you can't wait, you know. You can't cut it until you sing happy birthday. But someone is going to go up. Someone's going to grab a little bit of the frosting and taste it. That's a foretaste of the birthday cake. You know, I'm not enjoying it in its fullness, but I got some idea of what's going to happen. And that's the way it is with paradise through the mysteries. We get a foretaste of what paradise is going to be. In the mysteries, the life to come dwells in our souls and overcomes the life which is in the flesh and the beauty of this world. I wonder what's next. This is the way in which we draw this life into our souls by being initiated into the mysteries, being washed, anointed, and partaking of the Holy Table. When we do these things, Christ comes to us and dwells in us. He is united to us and grows into one with us. He stifles sin in us and infuses into us His own life and excellence and makes us to share in His victory. So we are victorious, but not because of what we've done, but because Christ has joined us. Christ has crowned us with victory. So we participate. We enjoy. You know, I think we've seen with the World Cup, you've seen on TV these huge masses of thousands of people, in San Francisco and New York and Chicago, and You know, the United States scores a goal and they go crazy. They didn't score the goal, but yet they rejoice in it. And so it is with Christ. And I mean, Christ wins the victory, but we rejoice in it. He does not merely bestow a crown or give the saints, the believers, some share in his glory. He gives them himself, the victor who is crowned with glory. And that's crazy. Because we're used to, like, you know, being excited because, you know, USA won. Or there's something with the Stanley Cup. People, like, have this obsession. It's like, I want to go and visit the Stanley Cup. But that's other. That's something that I touch. You know, an Olympic medal. I touch that, but that's not mine. But Christ gives us the crown. But Christ gives us more than the crown. Christ gives us himself. And so we become the victors. And so it's Kabasilas just does this whole thing. Remember we're talking about theosis and union with Christ? I couldn't because there's just so much stuff. I can't share all of it with you today. But he has this, he goes on this extended thing about Christ is closer to us than our own flesh. Christ is closer to us than our own skin. And this is what he's saying. Christ shares not only his victory, but his very self with us. This alone we contribute to this life, that we submit to his gifts, retain his graces, and do not reject the crown which God, by many toils and labors, has prepared for us. Nicholas Kabasilas is giving us such an encouraging sort of a message about the spiritual life. We don't have to do anything. So I don't have to worry about if I'm weak or if I'm strong. I don't have to worry if I'm talented or not talented. I don't have to worry if I'm dedicated or not dedicated. All I have to worry about is receiving the gift of God, receiving the grace of God, and retaining it, and not rejecting it. I mean, that's kind of a great life. That's kind of like Christmas morning, where the biggest thing on Christmas is make sure you find all the gifts. You know? And that's the way it is with God. We just have to accept. Do not reject the crown which God, by many toils and labors, has prepared for us. Toils and labors. And we accept them. And we enjoy them. And we're thankful for them. And it's a great blessing. And so, what we're going to do now, I think, is we're going to enjoy reflecting on these great blessings that God's given us. We're going to have the Akathist, and that's a time to remember and to celebrate the great things that God has done for us. And all we have to do is just sort of remember it, ponder it, welcome it, accept it, rejoice in it, and be thankful for it. And then the same thing's going to happen with food, I think. It sounds like someone's laboring. We need to accept and be thankful. Yeah?
Are we ever worthy to receive the mystery?
Well, these ought to us. No one who is bound to the desires and pleasures of the flesh is worthy.
But we put parameters in there. We say, you know, you're in prayer, you're fasting, and you're withdrawing from food for so long. We still put criteria there that somehow get confusing.
Yes, and that's because we misunderstand it. I have a friend. I have a good friend who's insane. And he went to Las Vegas twice in the past month. And he said, I'm not eating anything today because I'm going to go to the all-you-can-eat buffet at the Bellagio. And he knew that it was going to be opulent. He knew there was going to be more food there than he could deal with. And so he said, I'm going to discipline myself now and not fill up on McDonald's so that I can really enjoy this. And in that sense, fasting and preparation can be a very good thing. It's like I am anticipating so much spending this time with God that I'm not going to watch TV. Before a big event, sometimes we're just so caught up in it, we can't focus on anything but the big event. And encountering God and the mysteries is that. And in that sense, it's normal and it's healthy and it's good and it's natural. However, if we change it from an eager anticipation and preparation to, I have to do this checklist, and I can't eat anything, I can't drink anything. When we turn it from a natural thing into a checklist of things that have to be accomplished, then it turns bad. Because then we get this idea of I'm earning salvation. And it's like, oh, you know what? I didn't fulfill this. I can't go to it. No. No. Because Christ accepts us whenever and wherever we need Christ. But but it's not something we earn. It's not something we earn. So I think there's a delicate balance. There are different reasons behind what we do and why we do things. And I can anticipate through prayer and fasting this union with Christ. And that's great. But it shouldn't be something that I do just because I have to do it. I think. Yeah?
Maybe because we're dealing with our corrupted nature. And that's a create some difficulties.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fallen nature, fallen humanity. It goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. We think it's all about us. We think it's all about us, and it's not. It's really about God. We think I know better than God, but we really don't. So yeah, I think we think that our ideas are better than God's ideas. But if we focus on God, if we focus on Christ, maybe we'll realize that Christ is the ultimate. Yeah.
Does he address the issue that from the beginning to the end there is any variance in quantity or quality of God's gifts for the catechumen or the communicant at the altar or the recently reposed in the Lord?
No, and yes, and no. He doesn't really spend a lot of time talking about catechumens. He doesn't spend a lot of time about that. He just sort of says, when we are baptized. And so he's talking to people who are already baptized. So that's very different than homilies that are like St. John Chrysostom's homilies for those who are going to be illumined. Or, you know, St. Cyril of Jerusalem or something like that, you know. It's a different sort of a thing. So he assumes that his readers have already been baptized. He talks about the difference in quality between people who have remained faithful, who have kept this zealous acceptance of the torch, and they've protected it, and then those who have gone off and forgotten about it. And he realizes that a lot of these people are babies. And they're chrismated and they're baptized and they receive the gift of the Holy Spirit, but they're not in an environment where the gifts of the Holy Spirit are allowed to bloom. So he talks about that. And then what we can do if we've sinned to sort of come back. So he does talk about that. And then I don't think he spends any time really with those who have departed. So it's just sort of, he's talking to people between baptism and entering paradise.
Just to comment on the more we go over this and talking about kind of who he's talking to, it is evident. I'm very glad you started with all the historical stuff. I was going to call it dry history, but I don't think history is dry, and you didn't present it dryly. So, because it's very obvious in that context that he's talking to these kind of people, and that kind of we're like that today. In this, you know, we don't have a Christian emperor. We don't have, you know, and a lot of the traditional Orthodox churches, you know, if they're, we call them cradle, you know, Orthodox. And also those of us who come from, you know, convert Orthodox, we all need to have this kind of catechism of how to live in the world. You know, we have a lot of books translated into English about ethicasm and about all the monkish things to do. But for someone who has a 9-to-5, you know, this is going to be very useful.
We, at the Institute, and this is going to be the last thing I say, I think, because I think we probably need a few minutes before we go to Agathist.
Okay.
We had this with this one woman, a very, very bright woman, a very pious woman, who had a very strict spiritual father. And one of the things at Berkeley, one of the old chestnuts, one of the sweet conversations, if we've got nothing else to talk about because we're too busy to prepare, we throw the things out, we throw the question out, you know, what is it like trying to live a Christian life on the Berkeley campus? What's it like trying to be an Orthodox at a major university? That's a nice open question, and the students have experiences and they can share, and it's always very good. And so we were having one of these conversations, and this woman is a law student, and she said, you know, it takes a lot of guts to talk to people. And she says, how do you all manage to remain Orthodox? It's like, what do you mean? How do you remain Christian? So what do you mean? She says, my spiritual father said, before I do anything, I have to say, she said 3,000 Jesus prayers. And she said, you know, how are you able to study when you have to say all your Jesus prayers? And at that point, it was like, no one else in the room had that kind of a spiritual rule. And, you know, she went back to the old country, and she talked to a pious monk, and the pious monk was used to living in a monastery. And the pious monk said to say 3,000 Jesus prayers a day. And that's hard to do when you're a law student, a first-year law student. And so it's one of those things where different occupations require different spiritual disciplines. You know, I was talking to a spiritual father, and he says, you know, I've got someone who comes to me, and he's an airplane pilot. And so I tell him that he has a very different kind of a Lenten discipline. And he said, I'm going to give a different Lenten discipline to a surgeon. You know, because they really need a different kind of discipline than someone who's maybe, you know, a stay-at-home mom, or someone who has time on their hands, or someone who has that flexibility, someone who's a seamstress. You know, because he told this woman who is a seamstress, he advised her that with every stitch she takes, she needed to say the Jesus prayer. And she did it, and it was wonderful. And he says, but I'm not going to tell the pilot, you know, to have his kumbuskini in one hand and his and the steering wheel. I don't think the airplanes have steering wheels, the rudder, the whatever. In the other hand, he says, I want him to be totally focused on his job of navigating the plane. So I think that this is really an interesting thing because Kavasilis is speaking to people who are not unlike us. And that's why I get excited about this book. Sometimes I get excited and I love it. Other times I just read it and it's like, huh. And I think a lot of that's the translation. It would be really nice if someone did a new translation of it. But. Okay. According to the schedule, we've got 12:15 Agathist.